Committee on Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs will come to order. Welcome, everyone. We have three bills that we'll be hearing today, and they all have sponsors who are state representatives, so we're going to be taking the representatives' testimony because some of them have to chair committees, and then we'll be going back to the bills to take the public testimony. So if you will bear with us on that, we're opening as a subcommittee. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2649 and call the staff to do the summary. And I'd like to call Representative Alan Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2649 modifies the standards used to determine whether an individual or business entity performs labor or services as an independent contractor. Thank you.
Welcome, Representative Brown.
Thank you, Chair Close, and committee. About 35 miles west of Junction City, there's a small town of Blatchley. Blatchley actually consists of three buildings. You have a very small post office, then you have a fire station and sort of a community building, and then there's what used to be the Blatchley grocery store. It's been remodeled, and a company now called LRI is there. They manufacture small little lights, proton-type lights. They have been operating for a number of years in this area. Their owner, David Allen, told me that they, in the last year, they grossed somewhere around $8 million in product that they've sold and manufactured from this facility. They have been using what is private contractors. The community is very rural, and these people in this area that historically had been earning their living through the natural resource industries, either through farming, ranching, and primarily through timber industry in jobs in local sawmills and in the logging industry. And to a large extent, that's went away in this community, in this area. And so what David Allen was doing, they manufactured the small parts for these lights. They would go out into the community and provide, almost like a cottage industry, the opportunity for local people there to have gainful employment assembling these lights. He would provide them the people at, and they would do this in their home. He'd provide them with the parts, and they would take them home and assemble them, and then he paid them on a piecework basis for doing that there. My understanding is that some of the people would could earn around about, depending on how much time they put into it, around $20 an hour, and it provided a great deal of additional income for these people in these areas that are, are really strapped in this time. This created about 70 to as much as, I think 70 to as much as 100 jobs in this area where there is no other employment. This is it. He's the only person in the area that's providing him employment. He does some of the work within his small facility there, and he has a staff that works within that facility that are full-time employees. But the people that he was using basically to assemble these were people that were doing the work within their own home. He ran afoul of some of the private independent contractors laws and was told that he couldn't continue this type of practice there, firing people in this manner. And so so that is the genesis of this bill, to try to make it possible for him to continue to employ people in the area. There's people here that will testify later before you that are actually working for him and have worked for him. The alternative is that he moves these jobs offshore David is in China now, and when we're in the state of Oregon is very strapped for our jobs, and our economic condition right now is because of the lack of jobs. It just defies common sense to me to drive further employment out of the state, even though this is small. It's very important to that community there. And with that, I thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity.
Questions for Representative Brown? I guess I had one question on the article that was passed out. It says that they can't be independent contractors because they don't have separate phone lines. Do you know what that's all about?
There's a certain criteria within the statutes that they must meet to be an independent contractor, and I believe they have to meet four of those criteria, and one of those was having a separate phone line. Also, I think one of the reasons they were turned down was because they didn't have a professional-looking business card. And you know, and this is a very, very rural community. These people, their homes are probably at the closest located, at least 2 or 3 miles apart or more. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay, and, thank you.
Very important for the state of Oregon to discuss these issues. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2649 and go to a public hearing on House Bill 2130 and call Representative Backlund. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2130 deletes the requirement that retired local government employees be charged health insurance premiums according to family status categories, and it declares an emergency effective upon passage. And there is a fiscal statement issued as well as a dash 2 amendment. Welcome, Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Chair Close. Good morning, and welcome to this hearing. For the record, I am a Representative Dick Backlund. I represent House District 25. To my left is Legislative Assistant Gary Pello.
Welcome, Gary.
I'm here this morning to urge you to pass House Bill 2130. I also believe that it's important for me to give you a brief background about the events that have led to my authoring House Bill 2130. House Bill 2130 has its immediate predecessor in the form of House Bill 2084. Now, 2084 was passed by the 2001 legislative session by a 54 vote in the House and a 21-1 vote in the Senate. So it did have overwhelming support. The intent of that earlier bill was to accomplish two goals. One, to prohibit the establishment of a separate group of local government retirees for health insurance purposes. Two, to require that the health coverage and premium levels for local government employees be the same as those for active employees. As House Bill 2084 became statute and took effect as part of ORS 243.303, it became apparent that it was causing considerable confusion in the health insurance industry. Specifically, Section 1, Paragraph 3B, was causing the difficulty. To correct that, House Bill 2130 will eliminate one sentence from that earlier bill. That sentence is, quote, "The retired employees shall be charged a premium according to an appropriate category, including individual alone, individual and spouse, individual and dependents, or other similar categories." We had a meeting, my legislative assistant Gary and I had a meeting with representatives from Blue Cross Blue Shield and the insurance division. This meeting included legislative counsel Doug McKean, who had written House Bill 2084. The agreement at that meeting resulted in House Bill 2130, which simply deletes the last sentence, which I just previously quoted. The representatives, and I think, by the way, that should solve the problem. We've had additional meetings since that earlier meeting with the people from Blue Cross and the Insurance Commission and other insurance company representatives. So we think that we have solved the problem, and for that purpose, then we hope that today we can explain and answer any questions that you might have, and we do have a number of people here to answer any technical questions. So with that, Chair Close, That's my testimony, and we thank you for having the opportunity to come before your committee.
Well, thank you, Representative Backlund. Do we have questions?
I have one question, Mayor.
Representative Shoffler.
How much will this save retired folks?
Chair Close and Representative Shoffler, I think the big thing is that we're going to have, let's say, equity between retired local government employees and active local government employees. And I don't know that I could answer well your question about savings, Ed, because we don't know what the local government actives might hope to do in terms of changing the premium rates. We want to keep the premium rates equal.
I could perhaps answer that.
Yes, good.
I could perhaps answer that with one brief example of what happened to us. I led a task force about 3 years ago here in Salem-Keizer because as retirees we were separated from the active group. Our insurance rates immediately jumped by 70% because we were separated. That separation was in fact a violation of 243.303. And so that was what drove us to take this one step further to clarify.
Thank you.
And could I ask the drafters of that bill in 2001, 2084, was that just an oversight that they missed that?
Chair Close, that's a great question. I was on this committee in 2001. I think I sat right next to Representative Rosenbaum, as a matter of fact. And we had one of the other members who thought that he would be clarifying if we added the sentence that has become the sentence of confusion, I'll call it. And he thought he was doing the right thing. We thought he was doing the right thing. And the Legislative Council agreed. But as it turned out, the interpretation of that was not what we had intended. And so, again, our attempt here with this bill, House Bill 2130, is to clarify, is to remove the confusion and to straighten out the confusion. And hopefully there will be none of that in the future.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Morning, Representative Backlund. Yeah, I do have the same recollection, and it looks to me like this will just go back to the intent the committee had when we passed this bill out last session. I guess the lesson here is legislators do not always go down the smartest path when we try to improve on the work of legislative counsel. So,
Chair Close and Representative Rosenbaum, I would have a complete agreement with that. We have intentions that are good, and sometimes we stub our toes a little bit.
Okay, thank you very much. Very interesting. Representative Nelson, did you want to present on your bill before we work these other bills? We can take your testimony now if you'd like, if you have other obligations. Okay. All right, we'll call Len Hagen, Regents Blue Cross. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Leonard Hagen with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. I'm the Manager of Legislative Affairs. I do have one letter for the committee to introduce. Thank you. Pardon me. My comments will be brief. Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon insures a number of local governments referred to in ORS 243-303. We insure several school districts, several cities, and some fire districts. As the insurer, we must work with these local governments to make sure that retiree benefits are administered in accordance with the statute. And as you heard from Representative Backlund's testimony, A recent change to that statute made it unclear and created some uncertainty. Once we were aware of the uncertainty, we did work with Representative Backlund's office. We also worked with a work group that was set up by his office recently to address some of these concerns. We believe that HB 2130 clarifies the statute and will make it easier for us to administer benefits in accordance with Oregon state law. So we support HB 2130.
Thank you.
Questions?
Thank you very much. Okay, going to call Maxie. Is it McGillen? McGilver?
McKibben. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Maxie McKibben with the Department of Insurance, and I just wanted to confirm that I was part of the work group on House Bill 2130 and worked with the different members as to making the clarification on the grouping and application of active and retired members, and would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Could I ask you, Maxie, we're looking at the Dash 2 amendment. Was that what the work group came up with?
The copy, Madam Chair, the copy I have here is Dash 2, dated February 17th, 02.
Yes. I was just wondering if you could, since you were part of the work group, if you could just maybe tell us how you arrived at the amendment and what it done.
As part of the work group, the purpose of this sentence and to come to an agreement was to allow the public bodies to establish a rate that would apply both to active and retired members of the group and not separate the group by active and retirees for the purpose of different premiums or ratings.
Okay, and the words solely for the purpose of rating or of establishing a premium, a little unclear to me where that goes.
This is when a group is pulled together for the purpose of determining a premium on what's going to be charged per member per month. This wording is saying that the active member cannot be put over in a separate pool than the retired member and come up with two separate premium rates to be charged to the members.
So what you've done is removed the one sentence and then clarified it with this sentence, is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, thank you. All right, well, that concludes our testimony on 2130. We do not have it scheduled for a work session, so we will need to come back to that bill. So thank you, everyone who testified. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2130. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2480 and call Representative Nelson. And the staff will read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2480 establishes a tax credit for a taxpayer that employs and trains a person who has been released from incarceration. It applies to hirings made tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2004. And this does have a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee. Thank you.
Good morning, Representative Nelson.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2480. I thought that would be nice to say. I'm State Representative Donna Nelson from District 24. Chair Close and members of the House Committee on Business, I'm grateful for your time this morning. House Bill 2480 is a proposal which has grown out of a serious concern for the citizens of the state of Oregon. It is my hope that House Bill 2480 will result in a successful win-win endeavor for those who participate in this program. A win-win endeavor for business and society. A win-win endeavor that will generate a willingness on the part of our businesses and other entities to afford opportunities for inmates to be gainfully trained and employed upon their release from incarceration, and at the same time provide an employment source for the employers who participate. House Bill 2480 establishes a tax credit for taxpayers who train and employ persons who have been released from incarceration and provides for the carry forward of unused tax credits for a period of 5 years. While those specific figures have not as yet been entered into this bill, it is my hope that after additional research and study, you will allow us to return with an amended bill that will define those numbers. House Bill 2480 speaks to the critical need in our state to work together to provide employment and training to prevent recidivism among former inmates. Our safety and security, prison and justice systems constitute the top priority for state expenditures in the state. Without safety, all other state programs and citizen activities exist in potential peril. While we cannot hold law-abiding citizens responsible for the actions of non-law-abiding individuals, we do need to do everything we can to reduce crime. With the support of our employers, we can establish a more comprehensive employment environment that costs less than the imprisonment of individuals and at the same time eliminates idle hours, eliminates homelessness, despair, and the lack of self-confidence, skills, and self-sufficiency for inmates who have paid a price for wrongdoing and are returning to society to begin again. I'm submitting further documentation on this issue for your consideration. As we have examined other similar tax incentives that are being used in other states, one issue is very clear. We in Oregon are not alone. Documents show that recidivism is as high as 80%. We must further examine the why and immediately reinforce those programs with the what. The what that rebuilds lives of our released inmates and that of their families for positive futures for the citizens in our state. In 1999, there were about 3.8 million adults on probation and 700,000 on parole, according to the Justice Department here in the United States. One state program has placed more than 17,000 ex-offenders in jobs since September of 99. Tax benefits vary from state to state. Iowa allows an additional deduction to income tax returns for hiring ex-offenders. 65% of the wages paid in the first 2 months of employment with a maximum deduction of $20,000 per employee. This is in addition to targeted jobs tax credits. The ex-offender must pass the business's probationary period of 6 months for the purpose of this deduction. In the District of Columbia, tax credits are given qualified high-tech companies for retraining inmates for retraining jobs for qualified disadvantaged employees. Florida likewise has a program that trains inmates in money management, releases inmates into new communities to help them stay away from their old crimes, and reinforces the known fact that drug abuse accounts for half of drug-related crimes and is found that through treatment and training, 73% are less likely to be arrested in the first 6 months after release than untreated inmates. With literacy and GED programs, job fairs, apprenticeships, mentor groups, chambers of commerce, halfway houses, family programs, and faith-based and other nonprofit support come numerous other ways in which we can assist these individuals with a new start. Without employment, however, and with the limit on welfare support, housing, transportation, and other needs for families' well-being, we will not end the costly burden of incarceration in terms of victims' lives, funding for prisons, and repeat of crimes. House Bill 2480 can be a start in a collaborative process of rebuilding lives, an incentive for both employers and employees who desperately need employment. Our prison system can likewise be responsive with appropriate job training for participating businesses. With the help of our business community, we can make a substantial difference in these lives. To those businesses which take the risk, we can provide incentive to continue their efforts. I thank you for your support on this issue.
Well, thank you, Representative Nelson. This is a fascinating idea, and I'm interested to hear that it's being done in other parts of the country, and apparently with some success. Can you tell us, you are a businesswoman, could you just give us an estimate in Section 2 there where you have the blanks? It says that the credit will be the equal, shall equal the lesser of the percent of the cost that the taxpayer has put out to train the person, or an amount per person who is incarcerated. What do you think would be an amount, ballpark figure, of what this might cost to do?
Thank you for that question, Representative Close. We have had estimates and are having fiscal review those various estimates. To tell you the truth, in the documentation that I will be providing you, you will see that almost every state has varying amounts. And as far as at this moment of knowing why, some of them are vastly more generous than the ones I mentioned in my testimony. Others are funneled through other services like job training. It's just such a wide, consideration for a tax base. I was going to see if I had, possibly maybe can find it, some basics of other states. But anyway, the percentiles range, you know, from including the entire income for, you know, of course, I'm sure depending on the type of job it is, for an individual for up to 5 years, the entire income is a tax credit, to a proportion amount that decreases over the years. And that the change for that occurs with the individual becoming able to have benefits in this business or qualifying for benefits. So as the business provides the inmate, which I guess we wouldn't call them inmates then, but the individual, more benefits, then the subsidy declines. So I'm sorry at this time I cannot give you an exact number. I can and I will furnish you this information that shows you what other states are doing.
I appreciate that. I can see that it probably depends on the type of business, how much training would be required. I'm trying to, you know, think of what a reasonable amount would be, you know, in the blank per person. So if you could provide us with that, what other states are doing, I think that would be really helpful.
I'm very happy to do so.
Representative Gerard.
Good morning, Representative Nelson. What's the age limit that's applicable here? Are we talking about someone that may come out of OIA or under 18?
Thank you for the question, Representative Close and Representative Gerard. In these studies, I'm amazed to see that it's the full gamut that, you know, begins with Oregon Youth Authority on, as it would in our state, you know, on to, you know, infinitely, basically till Social Security would kick in. And if I might just add, and when you compare the tax incentive of keeping a young person out of OIA at $100,000 a year cost to the state and having them in, you know, beneficial employment, I think you'll see the advantage of this tax system.
Thank you.
Madam Chair. Representative Gallegos.
Hi, Representative Nelson. Thank you for coming today. My question would have to do with timing. Oregon has, we vie frequently with Washington for the highest unemployment in the nation, and the highest unemployment would probably be a very good guess. The majority of those are law-abiding citizens. Could we possibly be setting up our law-abiding community to be at a disadvantage for jobs, where we're looking for job creation, looking for tax incentives for companies to start hiring and expanding their businesses and put people back to work.
Thank you for that question, Representative Close and Representative Gallegos. You know, that's a kind of an interesting aspect of evaluating this program, and recently did this had kind of the same question as it came to transplants. You know, if you have an inmate in prison and you know, a citizen not, who should get the transplant, you know, and found out, you know, in the nation's eyes and God's eyes, we're all equal. So employment is important to both. I think there's incentive to hire individuals who will do the job, and I think that's what all employers have to look at, whether they've been individuals who have been incarcerated or those who've never been employed. They have to leave that decision with employer.
Representative Kitts.
Representative Nelson, I just like to follow up with what Representative Gallegos just said, and if what you're saying, if in the eyes of God and the country that we're all created equal when it comes to transplants and job opportunities, it doesn't appear so when it comes to this, because you're providing tax credits for one group and not the other.
Thank you for Representative Close, for Representative Kitts. Thank you for correcting what I said, and I probably deserved it.
And I don't mean to, I'm not correcting you. I want clarification. I know better than to correct you, Representative.
Thank you. We do have incentives for businesses, and I think the issue here is who is most hireable. And I hate to tell you, you'll find from the statistics here that, of course, this is the number one need in the release of all inmates. So in comparing the cost of keeping them incarcerated or repeat crimes, the need for an incentive appears to be more critically needed in this area than it does with good law-abiding citizens who are not going to have to provide $35,000 to $57,000 a year to keep them in prison. And also, if I might just reiterate, you'll also find that this information from our research, most of the repeat crimes of these individuals relate to drugs, and they relate to violations of parole and probation, not the recommitment of an actual crime. So in our society, the additional chore, the additional cost is in drug treatment, rehab for these individuals, and we're looking to the businesses to help us in those areas.
Follow up,
Representative Kitts.
I would just, and I think what you're trying to do here is noble, and I think it's a good cause. I would just point out my reservation with providing tax credits to people that are costing the state $50,000 a year to be incarcerated, versus providing employers for tax credits for employers that are hiring people that have just contributed $35,000, $50,000 a year to the state, and that would be recent college graduates. So I've got just some reservations, but I'm more than happy to talk with you in private about it.
Representative Close and Representative Kitts, you know, I certainly applaud you for being concerned about our college graduates. And the tax incentive here is not to the released inmate. It is to the employer.
Correct.
And,
or hiring the released inmate.
Who is hiring,
right,
and taking the risk.
Representative Shoffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. And you'll have to all forgive me, but you mentioned the state of Iowa, and I just wanted to say the state of Iowa is full of wonderful, qualified, intelligent, delightful people, and a lot of those kinds of people come from Iowa, too. Anyway. What I wanted to say is, you know, we are in a revenue jam and we're all looking for money, but I see a trend here in this building of letting our budgetary problems get in the way of good policy, and that I really am afraid, not just this issue, but a whole list of them. But what I wanted to know is, it's cheaper to have somebody out there working, being productive, than it is having them in jail. I think we all know that. You can do the math. And you don't have to answer this now, because you probably may not have done the math, but if you could come back with some math in these other states where they're successful, showing how much it would have cost if they went back to jail, and how much, you know, revenue they're putting in by being taxpayers, and then compare that to the investment we made, I think our investment, you may be getting a real bargain with this investment is what I'm trying to say. And you know, we all make mistakes in our life, and Lord knows I've made my share. And everything we can do to keep people out of jail is a human thing, but also it's a money thing too. And I just, that's what I wanted to say. And I think I don't want good policy, smart policy, human policy, and revenue creating policy being pushed aside because we're in such a jam. I don't think that would be wise government. That's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Close, Representative Schaffer. I appreciate your comments. And as we think of our increase in prison construction over the last several years, wouldn't it have been wonderful in this need for economic development if that had all been big building businesses, you know, big businesses, or out of those facilities come excellent, well-trained individuals who are, you know, have gone through rehabilitation and have paid the price for their crimes to the best of their ability. Not that that takes care of the victims ever in these situations, but then have a desire to give something much better back to society.
Representative Rosenbaum. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Representative Nelson. Following up on Representative Kitt's question, in my reading of the bill, I don't see anything that would prevent an employer from actually laying somebody off and then hiring somebody to take advantage of this tax credit. And I think that is a concern, particularly given we have massive unemployment and a lot of people who've exhausted their unemployment benefits now. So is that, I'm sure that's probably not your intention in this bill, but is there anything in the language that would prevent that from happening, displacing an existing employee?
Representative Close, Representative Rosenbaum, thank you very much for that question. And we have in one of these pieces of paper here exactly that situation, and it is one that you'd certainly want to address in this bill, and it gives the requirements for what qualifies as a qualified disadvantaged employee and who they can be replaced, and they cannot replace individuals who were terminated for anything less than what the business has already defined as, you know, productivity. And then there's a number of periods of months in which, you know, you have to live with your action. And you're right, it does have to be added to this bill, and it is an amendment that is needed.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Representative Nelson. Thank you for bringing this bill forward and for seeing a significant issue and brainstorming over how to address it. During my first session here in the legislature, we had an issue over the siting of a women's prison. And in the course of working on that, I came into contact with many women prisoners who told me their stories and about how difficult the transition had been for them out of prison. In fact, for many of them, what had been their salvation were jobs that they had while they were in prison working for the Department of Motor Vehicles, and they were able to sustain those jobs when they got out. And they said for their friends who didn't have that connection, that restarting up in society with the kind of badge of having been in prison and their own self-esteem deflated and the employer's tendency to not want to even talk to them made it enormously difficult. So I think you're addressing a significant problem. I'm appalled at what it costs to house a prisoner, which is something well over $30,000 a year. And the notion of investing some money to make their transition back to society successful makes a lot of sense. I'm not a particular fan of tax credits because they fly against the notion of zero-based budgeting. That is, when we cut budgets, it's really hard to bring in what we're spending on tax credits and consider it at the same time. So personally, I'd rather see an appropriation so that it could be reconsidered, you know, on a biennial basis along with other programs and weighed as to its effectiveness. And yet I understand the power and the simplicity for employers to utilize a tax credit, so I understand why you're going there. But so that's my reservation, but I applaud you in acknowledging and seeking to address this significant challenge.
Representative Close and Representative Murphy, thank you very much for what you had to say. I appreciate that. And at this time, as we looked at these, at the question of tax credits, I guess what we need to start calling it is tax trade-offs or something like that, because our tax cost trade-offs, because what we're hoping to be able to show you, like Representative Schaffler brought up, is that the tax credit that we are bringing forth will be less than the cost will be to the state of having that person incarcerated. So we hope by the time this research is down to the finite items that you're going to see that truly we're not taking funds. We're replacing costs with less burden and at the same time rebuilding lives. And I might just mention that one of the biggest issues right now is that we've heard from constituents is, what do I do with this child? And by the grace of God, I haven't had that burden personally, but I certainly do have good friends who do. And what this released inmate can do with idle hours is minimal at this time. And when they all have a need for transportation to get to jobs, you know, and they have no way to earn the money with which to buy transportation, and you know, they're relegated to a computer in a room, and you know, all sorts of not so good things seem to end up happening. And I hear this over and over again from parents of these individuals who have not had an opportunity for employment.
Representative Gallegos has a question.
And Madam Chair, I actually have two separate questions, so nobody else has another question.
Okay, we have Gallegos and Gerard, and then I am going to go to the next witness. We're running out of time, but go ahead.
My question is, and I appreciate that you've made no distinguishing or have not tried to distinguish about the types of offenses. However, recently we saw Multnomah County released a lot of people early who had not fulfilled their obligation that for serving their particular offense. And are we I'm concerned about the let me just even skip that question because it's not even a question. Okay, let me get to my real ugly question, is the tax liability, because I don't know how to phrase that previous question. The tax liability, the only cap on it is that they can't, the credit can't be more than the tax liability for that year, yet you allow them to roll that over for 5 years. And so the next year they can start accumulating credits and start rolling those. So this could be a perpetual, to me that signals there could be an incredible amount of tax credits generated if you're not able to use it all in 1 year and then spread it over five, multiplied by the number of years you're employing people. This is, it's huge.
Okay. Representative Close and Representative Gallegos, thank you for your question. I believe, according to what the intent of this bill was, to cap it at 5 years, and you know, so it wouldn't be have infinite life.
Well, however, if they employ that same person in the following year, is there a length of time, like that they can only credit one time, or if they employ this person for more than 1 year, into 2 years, 3 years, does each of those tax years allow them a credit to roll over for 5 years?
Representative Close, Representative Gallegos, yes, it does. And this is over a five-year period of the employment of that individual.
Thank you.
Representative Gerard.
Representative Nelson, let me give you a quick hypothetical situation. There's one job opening. There's one person with no criminal background who applies for the job. There's another with criminal background that applies for the same position. Because of the tax credit, the former convict receives the job. What do you say to this individual who has never done anything wrong but is now being punished, in essence, for not being an ex-convict?
Representative Gerard, that is a very good concern to have. Unfortunately,
as an employer, I have to look to the individual who I feel will do the best job in the employment with the required skills and for whatever we're asking, you know, him or her to perform. So I think we still have to leave that decision with the employer.
Well, thank you, Representative Nelson. This has been fascinating. I want you to know I myself was employed once as a head of a work crew of kids that came out of McLaren, and we were trying to get them job skills and back in the marketplace, and that was under CETA funds. And it is difficult to do that job, I know. And so you do need to offer incentives if you want that outcome in society. So I like what you've done here because it does give the employer the choice. If they want to take that on, it gives them some incentive. It's still voluntary. It's not mandated. So very interesting concept, and we will look forward to your amendment.
Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2480, and we're going to excuse me, we had other people to testify, pardon me. I'm going to reopen on House Bill 2480 and call forward Richard Sly of Yamhill County. And why don't we bring up Ginger Martin of DOC at the same time? Good morning.
Good morning. Can I make that up?
Please.
Okay. Chair Close and members of the committee, I am Ginger Martin of the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I'm here to provide information about the importance of employment opportunities for ex-offenders, such as those proposed in House Bill 2480. Any one of us is more stable when we have a job and we can afford a place to live and clothing and all the things that we need to kind of operate in society. And, of course, the same is true for ex-inmates, those leaving prison. The trouble is that offenders are more likely to return to a criminal lifestyle when they are without these kinds of supports, whereas you and I are not as likely to react in that way. The experiences of parole officers and as well as national research confirm the importance of employment in reducing the risk of new criminal behavior in those transitioning from prison to the community. A study conducted with parolees in Georgia shows a 1% reduction in the likelihood of arrest for everyday work. That translates into a 30% reduction in the likelihood of arrest over the period of a month. In the same study, a parolee employed for 1 year is 3.5 times less likely to be arrested than a parolee who's unemployed for that year. Not only is employment important to the success of offenders who are transitioning from prison to the community, it is also a challenge. About half of offenders who come to prison are not employed prior to their prison stay. According to the Oregon Employment Department, the hourly wages of former inmates are significantly less than those of other people served by the employment department, and they tend to have less education and less work history than other clients of the employment department. So this is a high-need group when it comes to employment. While in prison, they do learn some work skills through education programs, work training programs, and just by virtue of the work that they do while they're in prison, but they will depend on a willing employer to take a chance on them when they are released. A tax incentive could help create more of such willing employers. The Department of Corrections supports programs that increase the number of offenders who are employed while in prison and thus reduce the risk of criminal behavior during that time. Thank you.
And I think we'll go to Richard Sly also, and then we'll go to questions.
Thank you, Chair Close and members of the committee. I'm here in support of Representative Nelson's House Bill 2480, and I have to tell you, as a practitioner in Yamhill County, it's a privilege to appear before a House committee. In my role as the director of Yamhill County Community Corrections, I've worked for 25 years in the field of parole and probation, and the area that this bill touches upon is very fundamental to the success of folks. In the caseloads that we see statewide in the community, as well as those coming out of the prison, about 90% of the offender base are males. about 10% female from the prisons, and about 20 to 25% of our field or community supervision group are women. We looked yesterday at our caseload to get a good estimate to tell you what the unemployment rate is. And in our county, a rural county, we have a blend of folks that work in natural resources like the timber industry and farming and the nursery industry and such work as that. Even there, our rates of unemployment among our offender group is at least triple that of the statewide average on the low end, and it can go as high as 35%. We have offenders that are on supervision for probation from the courts for domestic violence. We have drug offenders, about 44% of the population of parolees and probationers living in the community are drug offenders, and person-to-person offenders as well. A job is really the key, particularly for men, to have a stable life and to be contributors. I was intrigued by some of the questions from the committee regarding the difference between law-abiding citizens and ex-offenders or ex-convicts. Our hope, I think, for a healthy community is that if you approach the notion that people returning to the community have served their time and are trying to improve their lives, presumably they're all law-abiding citizens, and that would be our hope as well. And I think that really contributes to a healthy community. A lot of the folks that we see, and I'm not trying to pity those that are lawbreakers, but they grow up in very disruptive homes, and their whole life, their career, is very disrupted. Some of our offenders are caught in a grip of alcohol and drug addiction, and we do urine tests and other surveillance methods to determine who's following the rules. Some people end up in jail. On probation, end up in jail as a result of those violations, and that's disruptive. If any of us today were taken out of our routine and placed in a situation where we'd be in jail for 30 days, it would be hard to hold our job, hard to hold our respect with our families. And I think that this bill takes the opportunity for the offender to be employed, and our experience is that a lot of employers, whether they're in retail or hospitality or agriculture, are very willing to hire offenders. So I would urge the committee to support this bill. I think it's a real fundamental basic improvement for people that are on supervision. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Representative Gallegos.
Yes, thank you both for coming today. Ginger, with the high unemployment rates that Oregon is experiencing right now, are we seeing an increase in those being incarcerated for a variety of whatever offenses? Are we seeing a rise in crime?
Chair Close, Representative Gallegos, the significant increase in crime type that I'm aware of is in the women's population, and it is, I think, a reflection of our increased attention paid to identity theft. So we're seeing more repeat property offenders among the women's population, and it's in large part tied to our attention to identity theft.
But is there a correlation with the, or do you find a correlation to extended unemployment that's been going on here in the state for some time, and people finding themselves then on the other side of the law?
Yeah. Representative Klaus, Representative Gallegos, I am not aware of a sort of cause and effect relationship in our prison admissions with the rate of unemployment. But that's an interesting question, and there may be a connection. I'm just not aware of it.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Well, I would like to thank you. I have found in my work, when I worked as a job developer in this area, that that employers, at least in Corvallis where I was, were very willing. They consider this part of their civic duty, not just a new employee, but to try to give something back to the community. That was their mindset on this. So it is a little different situation, and so I appreciate your testimony. Thank you. Okay, Jasmine, employment, and also Jan Dean, I will call you up together.
Good
Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Close, for the record, I'm Jan Dean. I'm the Assistant Director for the Employment Services Division and the Employment Department. And with me today is Ed Jasmine. He is a technician at the department. We are here at the request of Representative Nelson's office to provide some information on a federal tax credit program. We do not have information on similar state programs, but we do have information on the federal.
Madam Chair and Chair Members, good morning. It's great to be here. My name is Ed Jasmine. I'm the program coordinator for the Work Opportunity Tax Credit, which is a federal tax credit that serves, in addition to economic assistance recipients, recently released or incarcerated ex-felons. The credit itself, a little brief history, the credit itself provides an incentive for employers to hire individuals from 9 distinctly different target groups, including ex-felons, and provides a tax credit of up to $2,400. Please note this would be a federal tax credit, and this would affect the employer's federal tax liability.
Oh. Interesting. Questions for the panel? Okay. So I guess I have a question. So this is pending legislation, is that what you said? Or has this been passed?
The tax credit was implemented, Madam Chair. The tax credit was implemented back in 1996 through passage of the Small Business Job Protection Act.
Okay. Okay. Representative
Kitts. This is an ex-felon who is a member of a low-income family. So is there an actual threshold of earning capability in order to qualify for this currently?
Madam Chair, Representative Kitts, there is, and it's based on the lower level income, what we call the LLSIL table, or living level income table, standard income table. The table or the data itself is released annually by the Federal Bureau of Labor and Statistics for BLS.
Follow up?
Follow up.
Maybe Representative Nelson could nod her head at me. Her bill does not specify based on income level, does it? It's just simply... Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Fascinating information. So if we were to do this bill, then we would sort of be piggybacking, if you will, on the federal legislation. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, the distinction between House Bill 2480 and the federal credit, as pointed out by Representative Kitts, would be the economic disadvantage status. So that would be the added piece. So not only do you have a recently released ex-felon, but those that are economically disadvantaged. But yes, one, House Bill 2480 would represent a state tax credit, whereas the Work Opportunity Credit is currently a federal credit.
And would you have any information about any other state like Iowa and what the amount of their credit is?
No, Madam Chair. As far as the Work Opportunity Credit, since we are a grantee of the U.S. Department of Labor, in fact, it's the U.S. Department of Labor and U.S. Treasury that has joint administration of the program, and the states would act in part as grantees in order to issue the certification procedures for each of the respective states. We do have such data available. However, I would have to go through my regional coordinator.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Shoffman.
Yes. A comment and then a question. A comment about what was said about 40% of the ex-convicts were in jail for the first place for drug use. And we can go down to the tavern and drink yourself blind and with vodka, and we don't even care. But you know what? Somebody out there doing a drug that is socially unacceptable, and we make a big deal out of throwing them in jail at great cost rather than giving them help. That I just cannot understand our community doing that, but we do. That being said, if you have any data that would ease some of the concerns that were up here, if anybody who is a law-abiding citizen and does need and deserve a job, losing out on an opportunity because of these federal tax credits. You understand
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, the General Accounting Office, GAO for short, conducted studies back in March of 2001, and this study was on the employer practice of displacement and churning. Their conclusion that the credit in itself didn't influence or affect this on the basis that many of the targeted group represented within the credit would, since they don't have, oftentimes they don't have the necessary job skills to obtain higher level opportunities, they disproportionately represent areas where there are entry level openings. So the competition itself wouldn't really displace the workers simply because they're oftentimes in various labor markets, there would be a higher demand for entry level positions and an insufficient labor pool to fulfill that. So this was found not to be the case, and it would be a counterproductive process from an employer standpoint in terms of their hiring.
Okay. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize. I was out of the room for most of your testimony, but just looking at the numbers for the last 5 years that track how the incidence of using this federal tax credit, looks like we dropped off really dramatically between 2002 and 2003. In fact, went from 222 to 21. Does that reflect that we don't have complete data for 2003, or is that the result of our unemployment? Or?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair, the data in itself represents quarterly statistics, and the data is provided on a federal fiscal year basis. So federal fiscal year 2003, we only have the first quarter reporting, which is 21 certifications authorizing use of the credit. And those would be hires that employers made in Oregon that successfully requested authorization to use the credit at the end of the tax year. We still have three more quarters remaining before we close out on this year.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. Although it still would be about a 50% reduction from the previous year if we continued at that rate, it looks like.
We've identified a pattern of, in fact, I could point out from fiscal year 2000 to 2003, as the economy became less than appealing, that really affected the hiring of recently released ex-felons. The ex-felon target group would, in fact, be the most difficult target group to place out of those that are served through the Work Opportunity Tax Credit. As the opportunities become less, oftentimes the recently released ex-felons lose out.
Well, thank you very much for this testimony. This is fascinating. I did not know that there was a federal tax credit for this, so this helps us a great deal.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the
public
hearing.
Excuse me. Go ahead. State Representative Donna Nelson, may I just answer your one question, if I could, please? The tax benefits for Iowa employees, just to give you an example without going into all of these, the deduction is 65% of the wages paid in the first 12 months of employment. The maximum deduction is $20,000 per employee. And in line with these good people from the Employment Division, this deduction is in addition to the targeted jobs tax credits that are available. And for the benefit of Representative Gallegos, if 65% of an employee's wage does not meet the $20,000 maximum in a single tax year, the balance may be claimed the following year to the extent the employee worked fewer than 12 months in the previous year. So they only allow the carry forward of $20,000 total. And on the answer to, unfortunately, Representative Kitts and Representative Girard, an ex-offender has to meet the criteria to qualify for this deduction. The ex-offender must pass the business's probationary period, which is 6 months, for the purpose of this deduction, and the ex-offender must not be hired to replace another employee who was terminated within the previous 12 months unless that employee was terminated for misconduct in connection with employment.
If the employee left voluntarily, the ex-offender would qualify for the deduction. Just one example. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for that added information. And we will look forward to hearing more on that bill. The hearing on House Bill 2480. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2649. And thank you, everyone who is here on that bill, for your patience. Committee, we've had the testimony from Representative Brown introducing the bill, so now I'd like to call up, there's quite a few people that we have to testify, so I'm going to call them up in panels. Jim Welch, Oregon State Grange, Cindy Riggs, LRI, Alona Hartwig, LRI. And maybe we should have the staff refresh our memory here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, House Bill 2649 modifies the standards used to determine whether an individual or business entity performs a labor or service as an independent contractor.
Welcome.
Chair Close and committee members, I'm Jim Welch, lobbyist for Oregon State and Grange. And I'd like to have you place me, if you would, please, at the end of the lineup, that last here. I'd like to introduce four of the people from the trenches, from the beautiful community of Blatchley, that would like to talk about this and have their story for the committee. We have Cindy Riggs, Alona Hartwig, Jeannie Trudeau, and Debbie Borland, and I think they all signed up right behind me. So I will cede my initial time here and then talk about what we have as a work in progress as I respond to others. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so Cindy?
Great. So I'm Cindy Riggs, and I work at LRI. I'm kind of the third hand. There's David Dallas and myself. So I was the first employee at LRI about 4.5 years ago. We used to work out of the house. And at that time when we started building our product, we chose to use subcontractors as a cottage industry, not as anything much more difficult than that. Our business has grown. At that time when I started, we probably profited about $100,000 our first year, which we were quite excited about. And UPS would come and we'd take the picture of the five packages we're sending, and now we're about at $8 million. We've moved, of course, to a building, and throughout that time, our subcontractors have grown. So at one point, we had about 72 subcontractors building our product in their homes, manufacturing photon microlights. Manufacturing, it's all built by hand. Our product is a small micro flashlight. I don't think any of you have seen it. We have plenty. And
hold that up so we can.
You want to see that?
Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay. Start over here.
So it's all built by hand at home, and we supply the goods they build, that they bring it back, we buy it from them. On a purchase order basis, what we used to, we don't anymore. As you know, we're halted from doing that. And so we've gone from the 70-plus people. We had roughly, because they could work on their own time, so it wasn't anything that we had any control over, nor did we want to. There wasn't any benefits for many of these people. So we did our production such as. Now they have to come in the building, which, you know, we have one major building, which we purchased and redid in the years of 98, 99. We moved out of the house at that point into the building and brought in offices, which, of course, they didn't really have before. And we also brought in packaging. We get our product back, and then we have to package it to ship, and then we have a shipping department. And then over time, we had to have these many people. We then were halted from doing that. And so all those people are now out of a job, except for the 14 people that I was able to fit in the building. So now they work, well, sorry to say it, under somebody else's control in a building in a little table, kind of. Matter of fact, looks like this, little compartments that we built. And we only have now the 14 people building versus the 72 people that we had building. And now I have to control how production is done because there's only so much table space and we still need the production that we have. And we're still a growing company. And then this has affected many lives. That's why I got again Alona here. There are two people that were subcontractors that were invited and struggled for. I invited them and then they struggled for quite a while to decide if they could come in the building, and both of them have decided to do that. And so that's why they're here.
So they had been working in their homes, is that what you said?
Yeah, both of them for quite a long time. Alona, since about 95-ish or so, and Debbie, yeah, Debbie just after that. So they did it for quite a long time, and they do make decent money. They've always been paid well. We don't pay like by the cent or anything. You know, we paid 40 cents a piece on a photon 2 basis, which is one of our main products. And they were paid quite well, so they weren't exploited. They weren't doing anything dangerous. They were subcontractors, so they did have to pay, file a Schedule C or pay their own taxes. But they were paid well, and so it wasn't like deepening them. We've also been accused of, other than the exploitation, the benefits issue. And we are a small company in a very rural community, and so the employees in-house, we don't have any medical benefits or anything as it stands now. So they weren't losing out there. Anyhow, so here we sit, and I have 14 people now building full-time. I have two shifts, small building, in a nice rural community in which most people are quite self-sufficient. Mm-hmm. So that's my point.
And your employer, Mr. Allen.
Yeah.
Is in China right now, and is it correct that he is?
That is true.
Thinking mm-hmm. of taking those jobs to China because of the difficulties
correct.
Here in Oregon.
And on new product, it's hard to build a company off of a hand-built Oregon light. You know, it's really exciting to go around the world and make a niche to sell this flashlight. And yes, it is expensive to build, and it is an expensive flashlight to build. But that's one of the great characters that comes along with the light, and. So that's true, that we can't afford to keep it here. And sorry, we all know about it. So we're looking in China.
Okay. Did you ladies have additional comments?
I do.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to introduce myself. I'm Alona Hartwig, and I'm a 39-year-old wife and mother of six children. I've lived in Blatchley, Oregon for a little over 8 years now. I had the opportunity to meet the Allens, both David and Dallas, at one of our local events, which was the Blatchley Community Fair. That was about 6 years ago. I remember seeing David, who used to be a jeweler, teaching some of the children how to make jewelry. It was particularly rings that they were wearing. And I had noticed that he had his product there for sale, which was the Photon Microlight. That fall, I was at a high school basketball game, and I had noticed a couple people sitting in the stands ringing these lights while sort of cheering our team on, and I found that quite intriguing. So after a conversation I had that evening, it sort of led me over to the Allens' home, which is where I learned how to assemble these beautiful little flashlights. I had not been working out of the home at that time. It was a decision that I had made. I didn't feel that it was economically possible for me to drive anywhere from 60 to 80 miles round trip for employment to work, you know, 8 hours and spend 3 hours of traveling time. It just took me away from my family that much longer. So I had made that conscious choice that I would stay home. That opportunity came my way, and I thought that this was a good thing, and my family would benefit from that. Also, you know, with the wear and tear of the automobiles and tires and gas and all that, air pollution, I didn't see that it was worth it for me to drive into town. So I was excited to have that opportunity to become an independent contractor where I worked the hours that I wanted. I set my own schedule. If I woke up at 4 in the morning and couldn't go back to sleep, I would get up and build lights and would stop when the kids got up for school. And I was able to really work around what my family's needs were. And I was really excited about that. I understood from the beginning that I would be my own boss, that I would be responsible for my own taxes, which I did file my Schedule C. I had the choice, you know, as to whether or not I wanted to hire help, which I chose not to do. I also knew that I could choose to offer my services to other companies. However, in Blatchley, there isn't any other companies. And that's all there is. So I guess I'm asking, is it right that I be penalized for living in such a rural and beautiful community? I personally felt that there wasn't a need for me to have a business line. I didn't want to pay the money to be licensed or bonded. My husband and I did, however, print up on the computer some business cards because we had a little bit of property and we raised livestock, and I did some arts and crafts on the side and did some fair shows and stuff. So we just had these little homemade business cards that we handed out, just which sort of included, you know, the photon lights, the no longer doing my hobbies, and we sold the livestock and we're no longer handing out any of those business cards. The experience of working at home was really amazing to me because I thought only in America could I work at home, make a livable income, which was really 2 to 3 times the minimum wage, while I'm still diapering my children, reading them books, volunteering at school, helping with homework, and etc. It made me feel like a great contributor to my relationship with my husband, being able to be able to contribute financially. And I was so excited to work at home that I had even agreed to pay Uncle Sam 10 to 15% more in income tax. However, this American dream ended for me when the employment office said, "No, Mrs. Hartwig, you're no longer an independent contractor." So you may ask, where am I now? I am a employee at LRI, and I've been there since May. I'm now away from my family. I'm not available when they need me. I work at 5 in the morning, which I get up about 3:30 in the morning, and I'm no longer getting them off to school or doing lunches or getting them dressed and usually bombarded with telephone calls looking for things that they need for school. And normally by the time I'm done working, I'm exhausted from being away. And even at home, I never worked 8 hours straight. It was so broken up during the day. It was wonderful. And to be honest, I'm no longer making the same amount of money. I'm actually making less, being paid hourly due to the fact that there's no child care in our area. My husband's also had to change his shift at work to help accommodate our family needs. Our family has been disrupted by the decision made to not allow me to sort of work within my own freedom. You know, I sit here and I feel like I'm an intelligent and smart woman, and I just want to let you all know that I wasn't enslaved to this. I wasn't exploited. In no way, shape, or form was I ever taken advantage of by LRI. Because it's on the contrary, David and Dallas have got so much compassion for all the people that they have contact with. And I know that they want the world to be a better place. And they work on that by starting within their own community where they're highly respected community members. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? Let's say Merkley.
Thank you very much for coming. I'm kind of puzzled as to why the location has become such an issue in this because lots of people can be employees and work at home. So did you all try to, did you, the company and the
now employed, try to work out an arrangement that was an employee relationship where she could work in her home?
Yeah, I'm assuming that you're...
Yeah, I'm trying to get... Why did that become... Why was that an obstacle? Because the law doesn't create that obstacle. It allows that opportunity to be an employee and to work at home.
It does, except on a manufacturing basis. It does. A lot of people, like office workers, they can work at home, but manufacturing is not supposed to be done working at home, and they're considering it manufacturing, and so there's liabilities and stuff that we can't find people to cover because it doesn't make sense. They're not just working on a computer. A lot of people like do medical. Well, that's still Schedule C. Office work, you know, if you were have your office job, you can take your work home and doodle around with it. And we've found obstacles in that about manufacturing in the home and the liabilities against that and how do you get your safe insurance. And we've have people investigating how it is that somebody would write that and et cetera, et cetera.
So kind of insurance is a major obstacle to the in-home manufacturing, if you will. That's kind of what's driven it to this current situation.
Correct. But then we started in this situation. We didn't drive into it, if that makes sense. You're saying now? Because we were perfectly happy for
right.
6 years.
Right.
It wasn't.
Yeah. Okay.
Gabby, did you want
starting over? We just lost our appeal not too long ago, so mm-hmm. we're still investigating all this, but there's rules about manufacturing your home.
I see.
So you did appeal this?
We did.
Okay, and Debbie Borland.
I'm Debbie Borland. Just a few words. I also live in the community. I have four children that I'm raising, and it was a choice for me to stay at home, which I enjoyed because I feel raising children is the most important thing that you can do in life. And when the opportunity arose to work in my home, I thought that was just the most wonderful thing. You know, wonderful people, they were doing great, and it enabled me still to stay active in my children's lives. The schools, which have such severe budget cuts right now, they need so much help, and I was able to volunteer consistently, and the schools counted on that. Also, for the last 12 years, I have been a member of a fire department and emergency medical technician, and I put a lot of work and a lot of hours into it. Excuse me. And I think I've helped a lot of people. And when the door closed on the opportunity to work at home, the opportunity was there to work in-house for the business. I actually stayed at home for a month because I just wasn't sure I could do it with my family. The choice was made. I needed to do it. You know, it was just beneficial for the whole family financially and such. And but with that has come hardships, of course, with the children. And I'm currently taking a leave of absence in the fire department. I was the only emergency medical technician for the community during the daytime, at which working at home I could go at any moment's notice on call and such, which was very beneficial, and it's just been very difficult. I feel like the community is losing out on so many of us that were involved in the community because we no longer have the time and can do that, whereas when we worked at home, everybody was involved in the community. It was really great. So I just really hope that you can see your way to changing. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. A couple questions, Representative Schaffler, and then Representative Girard.
I think I missed what you said earlier. Before you had to move to the building to work, you all were licensed, bonded, insured contractors?
No.
You were not?
We were not.
Okay, may I? I just want to follow up.
Follow up.
My concern is this. If we allow you all to be independent contractors on the site where you're building, then what's to stop Freightliner and Boeing and all these huge manufacturers are saying all our employees now are independent contractors too. We're not going to pay workman's comp, we're not going to pay unemployment insurance, we're not going to pay any benefits. And they could, I understand you're caught in this steamroller situation. You're in the system and it's screwing up your life, and I appreciate that. That if we make an exception for one business, we're going to have to make them for all the businesses. And that's the only concern. And if you all were licensed, bonded, and insured subcontractors out of your home, then I'd have no trouble. Then we wouldn't even be here. That's my concern. That's why I'm really worried about something like this.
And I would direct the committee to Section 1, Subsection 8, where it gives the circumstances that exist that these can be granted. Representative Rick was next, and then Kitts.
I was just curious, from all three of you, when you did work for this company, what was your average monthly growth?
I can speak for myself. We received purchase orders, so within the purchase orders, it would let us know what the number of lights that were needed for me personally to build. So maybe I got a purchase order, and there was a need for the month of 6,000 lights, so I would break that up to about 1,500 lights a day, $200 per batch. I average 600 a week, 2,400 a month. When we were really busy and we did have a Christmas where we had a real big crunch, they paid more for the lights, and I had a couple weeks where I was making about $1,200 a week.
And now working in-house, we make $11.
We make $11 an hour.
It's
40-hour week.
Yeah, less than twice what we were making.
I wasn't interested in what your hourly wage was, but how much you grossed in a month's period.
Okay.
$2,400. I believe I on one of my Schedule Cs, I had just a little under $30,000 for the year.
Mm-hmm. And the other two of you wish to answer that?
Oh. With me, actually, I didn't make as much as Alona did because I have so many other commitments with the community and school and such. But anywhere between, I think at the lowest it was $1,000 gross a month, but usually around $2,000, between $15,000 and $2,000.
I'm an admin. I've never been a subcontractor. I've always run the business and had the subcontractors building, so I've never built.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, panel.
Never mind.
Go ahead. Sorry. We have a half hour to get through another eight people, so make it quick.
I'm done. Good. I'll wait till the next person.
Okay. I appreciate you coming so far to testify, and I know it's a long ways, and it's also, I'm sure it's difficult for you to come up and testify before strangers, so we really appreciate you coming and making the effort. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to call Jean Trudeau and Don Schellenberg as a panel, since they are both for this, and then we will go to the three people against it as a panel. Welcome.
Chair Close, committee members, my name is Jean Trudeau, and I appreciate the opportunity to be able to testify in favor of House Bill 2649. In particular, I'd like to speak about our community, the town of Blatchley and the Lake Creek Valley. I've been a resident for 20 years, active in many of the community groups, particularly the Grange, where I was master and secretary. And we forwarded a resolution through the state Grange, which came to this legislative body. The Lake Creek Valley is a rural community. It's in the coastal mountain range, about 40 miles north and west of Eugene. In a 10-mile stretch along Highway 36, with all of its side roads, we have 440 registered voters. We have one school teaching kindergarten through 12th, and this year we have 140 kids in school. There's one dairy farm, five small cattle ranches, two country stores, one church, with another church body that meets at the Grange. Artisans in our valley produce leather goods, stick-built furniture, handcrafted pottery, jewelry, but there's only one major employer in our valley, and that's LRI. Our residents were thrilled that David and Dallas Allen, the owners of LRI, went out of their way to establish cottage industry in our valley. Folks choose to live in our valley because it's beautiful, it's peaceful, it's quiet, it's a wonderful place to raise children. You know all your neighbors, and they're all like extended family. But like most rural communities, the majority of wage earners have to commute into a city to earn a living wage. And if you find a job in Eugene, for us, that's an 80 to 90 mile round trip. So if you can't carpool, and generally you can't, you're increasing wear and tear on our fragile road system. And there aren't that many jobs to be had. There's also hunger in our valley, and you are all well aware of hunger in Oregon. Triangle Food Box, which is a nonprofit program operating through Triangle Grange, has seen an increase in their client caseload in the last 2 years. We started with, 2 years ago, 30 families. We now provide food for 100 families in our valley. Coincidentally, this increase in food box client caseload has happened during the period when LRI was forced to drop its independent contractor agreement, a time during which the LRI-generated cottage industry ceased in our valley. For those of us who have raised children, we know the value of having a parent at home. The loving care and guidance that a parent can give a child. And this is a vital missing element when, as often happens, both parents have to be out of the home, when economics force them both out to make a living. Leaving the child to be a latchkey kid, which today is defined as an at-risk child. None of us want to endanger kids. And the unique cottage industry that LRI established enables single parents and those with young children to stay at home and earn a decent living wage. They could care for their kids when they were little, or they were there when they came home from school. You didn't have to buy a lot of gas or replace tires, and you weren't adding pollution to the air. I strongly urge you to consider passing the amendments that House Bill 2649 would make to the definition of an independent contractor. Thank you very much for your attention and for the opportunity to speak.
We'll go to Don Schoenberg, and then we'll have questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Don Schoenberg, Associate Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau. I don't remember the year it was, but I believe it was sometime in the 80s when the current language was put in the statute. The Farm Bureau was a part of that discussion and part of that legislation. I remember working awfully hard to try and get the agency to come to a point where we could have rules and enough criteria that would allow the agriculture community to work as independent contractors, which is what they had always done. Suffice it to say, we support the change in the criteria so that individuals can be self-employed and enjoy working at a place and at a pace that suits their needs. This should be allowed in as many instances as possible, as long as we aren't abusing the working conditions of actual employees. Farm Bureau is not opposed to reducing the number and description of the criteria, as long as it enables accepted independent contractor agricultural activities to continue. House Bill 2694, as drafted, though, does present some serious concerns in that regard. One of the common independent contractor activities in agriculture is referred to as custom farming. All farmers don't own all of the equipment necessary to plant or harvest all of the crops they produce. In most cases, they can not justify the expense for the number of acres they have of that particular crop, or they may be producing two different crops that require an activity at the same time, and they only have time to do one. In some cases, they hire an independent contractor because they don't want to have the hassle of all the paperwork that goes along with hiring an employee to do the work. And that's when you hire the neighbor or the person who owns the machine and moves the equipment from farm to farm, conducting that activity for a number of farmers. Another common one is the fertilizer and pesticide applicator. He may not own a farm, but he is spraying material on farms every month of the year. In ranching country, there are those who build fences as an occupation. Some high school kids made a business in the summer of going from farm to farm and putting growers' hay up into their barns for them. That was their summer job. In each case, the independent contractors are doing things farmers or ranchers might have an employee do. So how do you tell the difference? Well, that's where the criterion subsection 8 that the chair referred to comes into play. And we certainly agree with the change on page 1 because the independent contractor is required to meet 4 of the criteria out of the 6. And so we had to have all the 6 criteria there in order to meet those, in order to be able to meet 4 out of the 6. The Oregon Farm Bureau strongly recommends that all of the criteria be left in place on page 2, and that the language in 8 and language in 8B and E were specifically included for agriculture, as was the language at the beginning of 8A. Talked to Representative Brown after he gave his testimony, indicated we were very interested in this issue. He said this was a work in progress, and we'd certainly want to be a part of that work to the extent that we're able to do that and that you allow us to. I have provided some proposed amendments there. If those are acceptable, you know, to the group as we work through this, we would encourage their adoption. So with that, I'd like to close by indicating again our support for the concept of what's going on here. But then, again, want to make sure that agriculture, independent contractors, custom farmers, et cetera, are able to meet the qualifications. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. I guess I didn't realize that agriculture was so much a part of this discussion, so I appreciate you bringing that. Questions for Don or Jean? Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Don, I'm still trying to get to the core of the issue about why there isn't flexibility under the current laws. Is it just impossible to get workers' comp to cover an employee who's doing an assembly process in their own home? Is that what basically makes it impossible to have an employee relationship?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, no. I believe that the crux of the whole matter here is that there are 6 criteria that you have to meet in order to be an independent contractor. And of those 6, you have to meet 4 of those. And that's a pretty stiff set of criteria to meet. And these folks were not, if I read it right and understand, and I'm not an expert on what their particular situation is, but my sense is that they couldn't meet 4 out of the 6.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
I think you misunderstood my question. My question, and a background is that I'm involved in hiring translators. Sometimes we hire these translators as employees, and sometimes we hire them as contractors, depending upon the circumstances. And whenever we're in doubt, we hire them as employees because that's what we've been advised to do by our advisor. But that employee relationship has a lot of flexibility. And I'm trying to understand why the employee relationship won't work for these people to still be in their home and be employees. And is it simply that if I chose to, if I was in this business as Laughing Rabbit is, and I wanted to have an employee relationship, is it simply that I can't get workers' comp to cover a manufacturing activity within a home? And is that an alternative way to address this problem if that's the obstacle?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, I probably am not going to answer your question directly, as I can't speak for LRI, I think it is, the employer, don't know what their motivation is. I would simply refer back to my testimony and from agriculture employer or agriculture individual's point of view, business individual, they don't want the hassle of having an employee if they don't need to. And that's the guiding factor, and that's one of the guiding factors. The other factor, as I mentioned, is they may not have the time or the equipment to do that work. So there's a combination of things that determine whether or not you have an employee. A lot of farmers choose to have employees because that works out best for them. For other farmers, it doesn't. And again, then there are those farming activities, those custom farmers, who make a business of doing those various activities for the farmers that they don't want to do or choose not to do for themselves with an employee.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Don.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, we're going to go to the next panel. It'll be Patrick Green, Oregon AFL-CIO, Lisa Trussell of AOI, Renee Bryant with the Employment Department. Good morning.
Teacher's pet.
Madam Chair, Patrick Green with the Oregon AFL-CIO. If it pleases the chair, I'd like to bring up Bob Shiprack and have him with Lisa start off our testimony. Thanks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bob Shiprack, Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council, and also here this morning representing the Employment Advisory Council, a labor management group that advises the Employment Department on legislation, policy, and other internal things. I want to take just a minute this morning to talk about the issue in front of you, because you need to know, when you stick your toe in the water on this issue, what it all entails. I did that back in 1987, the House Labor Committee at that time. I want to tell you what it was like in those days, an economy somewhat similar to what we have today, not very good. And we were using what we commonly call the common law test, still used by the federal government, to determine what's an employee and what's an employer. It sounds pretty simple, but it's not. The committee at that time, which would be your committee today, deluged with legislation trying to wrestle with the question of employer and employee relationships. And what we had going on in those days was an interesting situation where people learned they could game the system. You could be an employee one day, an employer the next day, because based on that common law test that was used at the time, it was pretty simple. You also had an interesting situation where differing opinions from state agencies. Workers' Comp, for instance, basically was much more liberal about these employer-employee relationships. So you could be an employer for workers' compensation purposes, but the Employment Department may look at you as an employee when you went and filed unemployment insurance. There was such a thing on a I'm going to try and go as fast as I can. There was, under the common law test, a good example. We went through this in committee over and over again. In order to form a partnership and be independent contractors, all you had to do was have a handshake. So when you're sitting in your pickup truck, getting ready to go roof the house, shake hands, we're partners, we're independent contractors, go up there. What often happened was you fell off the roof, and this was the joke in the committee, on the way down to the ground you became an employee. You then filed for workers' compensation benefits. There was no coverage, so all the other employers throughout the state within that classification got to pay for your injuries. Same with unemployment insurance because it was not defined. There was no clear rules. Any one of us could take a look at a certain employment situation and come up with differing examples of whether or not you're an employee or an employer. I finally, we had another bill in. It had to do with a logging contractor. He didn't have more than two contracts. And finally, at that point, the committee and myself said, we can't do this anymore. We've got to come up with a bright line standard to try and determine who's an employer, who's an employee for the basis of employment law. This, and I'm not going to talk about the specifics of this bill because, frankly, in my opinion, it's immaterial. This bill applies to about 80,000 employers and about 1.5 million employees should this bill get signed into law, and changes that relationship pretty substantially in how you determine who's an employer and who's an employee. We tried and we worked for the entire interim, 18 months, with industry and business to come up with a fair, objective standard that everybody could understand and quit the gaming that was going on throughout the Oregon economy at the time. Step back just a little bit more. This definition of independent contractor forms the very basis of employment law in this state. It's not just workers' compensation and unemployment. It's safety and health, OSHA, wage and hour, overtime, minimum wage. I just wrote a few things down. Employee benefit programs, discrimination in the workplace. All those other laws are based primarily on what is the definition of what's an employee. Enough said. I just wanted to leave you with those thoughts that this proposed change is going to upset what we've had in Oregon since 1989, I believe. There have been very few problems, and I want to leave this with the committee. The problem we sought to correct got corrected. The gaming quit. We now have a bright line standard in our statutes that allow employers and employees and government to determine who, in fact, is an employer and an employee. Sounds simple, but we've got it now. I should tell you one last thing. We ran this by the Internal Revenue Service. They actually helped with it along with the business community. Their comments when we were done was, we only wish that the federal government, IRS, had as clean and objective standard of determining these issues as we do now in Oregon. And with that, I'll just stop and see if you have any questions.
Any questions of this witness? Representative Garrard.
Bob, what about the 75 jobs that would be affected just in the LRI case that we've heard this morning? We lose 75 jobs in the state of Oregon.
I'm pretty sensitive about job losses, Madam Chair, Representative Garrard. However, I want to go back to when I said this forms the very basis of employment law. You also have to have, in a free enterprise system, fair competition. And you cannot allow and let one instance dictate how every business in this state is now going to be changed. And I think Representative Schaffler had a good point. What's to stop anybody else from, just because they don't want to pay unemployment insurance, which, by the way, is a very important thing in rural communities, when these people don't have those orders, there's no unemployment insurance, who buys the groceries at the local store, who pays the bills? It's a very basic foundation of our system. And all employers need to have a baseline standard to go from, and that is the current law, and people who choose not to live by that, all I can do, representing, say I'm sorry, but those are the rules, and it's unfortunate that this person chose not to provide those basic benefits to their employees.
Thank you.
Representative Kitts, you have a question?
I do, briefly. Good afternoon, Bob, or good morning, I guess.
Yeah.
My question is this, is what is to stop these individuals, and I'll speak directly to these individuals that are here today, from installing a phone line at the cost of $60,
mm-hmm.
registering with the state,
yep.
at a cost of, I believe, $10, buying business cards for $60, and providing the service to everybody that would potentially want it and deem themselves to be independent contractors. It would appear that they would fulfill four of the six current if they were to do that at what my estimate to be a cost of about $160, and then take on the responsibility of being the independent contractor, which you wouldn't have to actually have workman's comp if they were the owner of their own business.
That's correct.
Unless they had an employee, and they wouldn't have to pay payroll tax. But they would just simply be liable for the taxes, the income tax, state and federal, that are incurred upon a business. And I say that because it's pretty much what I've done.
Mm-hmm.
And what is to stop, and I provide my service, be it landscaping or consulting, with either one of my businesses, to anybody that wants it. If I only have one contract, or if I have two, I see that as being more the problem of having to have more than one contract is where I would have a hang up with this, as opposed to requiring these individuals to jump through the same hoops I had to.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't. What is prohibiting them from doing those steps and calling them independent contractors? Because it would appear that they would meet four of the six. They may not meet the one that requires more than one contract. They may only have one contract with LRI. Can you help me out with that?
Madam Chair, Representative Kitts, I'm not familiar with the specifics of this issue, of this LRI, whatever it is.
Let's just speak in general.
Because I really, as I said earlier, I don't, that's not the issue to me. But to go directly to your question, we set up these tests, and I think Mr. Schellenberg brought something out. I'm baffled as to why they eliminated two of the tests of the six. That restricts the ability of somebody to try and achieve independent contractor status. That's baffling to me. I don't understand that. But there perhaps could be a way, but on the surface, from what I've just heard in the back of the room, there might be some issues. I'd like, frankly, I've not heard from the Employment Department as to why they didn't meet the four tests. I don't know. But there could be a way. I'm not saying they're prohibited.
But you're not. I guess my underlying question is you're not opposed to allowing these individuals to be independent contractors if they were to do the following.
They follow the law.
Install the phone line, buy the business cards, open their services up to anybody that may need their service.
Mm-hmm.
If they can only handle one client, they only handle one client. And as long as they follow the law that all of us small business owners, people that are required, to follow, I don't understand it, because it would appear that they could accomplish what they want to accomplish for about $150.
I mean, bonds are cheap.
And they make twice as much money as we do.
I know.
Mr. Shepard, go ahead and comment.
I'm done.
Thank you, Bob.
Go ahead, Lisa.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and here today in opposition to 2649 as it's presented, because, as Bob's indicated, the history, but we think that there's broad ramifications to the changes to try and affect one entity. So we're concerned about what the unintended consequences would be. In the last 9 years that I've been with Associated Oregon Industries, there's been probably two times that I can recall, and I handle employment law and health policy for our members, where it's been an issue where they came up, where the issue came up. It hasn't come up to the level of us wanting to introduce legislation. Recognize that there are some definite concerns with the group that is here today in support of this bill. We've indicated to Representative Brown that we'd be happy to try and work with the group to come up with something, but that this changes far too much the parameters for too many people, and it would impact the narrower you craft the people who are required to pay unemployment insurance, as you well know, then for those who are left paying, that increases the load on them. So broader is better, but I recognize they have an issue and be happy to try and work on something. But these changes, we think, would just they're too broad.
Okay, Lisa, I guess I want you to sort of, this is sort of a broad question, but my concern is, you know, I understand the concern for trying to maintain our system in good working order of regulations and protecting workers. However, they don't have those in China and a lot of other countries. So if we don't have some flexibility, how are we going to prevent losing a great number of our jobs overseas?
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, as you heard during the interim from a variety of sources, you know, that their jobs are leaving the Oregon economy, and the goal for the legislature is to try and encourage job development in Oregon and keep them here. And my concern with this bill, the way it's crafted, is as Bob's indicated, it affects a lot of other issues besides unemployment. And so I think that if you're going to make a significant policy change from what we've had that's been fairly successful for over a dozen years, then I think that we need to be careful on how we craft it. And I believe that prior to this, we did follow similar to the federal, mm-hmm. and that created problems, mm-hmm. because, as Bob indicated, different agencies had different interpretations. So that's my comment.
Okay.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Actually, I was trying to tell you that Representative Merkley had a question.
And before you do, I'm just going to say that session starts at 11. I'm going to stay and take the remainder of the testimony, and because I think we need to do that, and we need to keep going on this for at least another 15 minutes. So. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, I'll save my question for whoever's going. Is somebody going to testify for the Oregon Employment Department?
Yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, with that, I'll trade seats.
Thank you, Lisa and Bob.
Thank you.
And this is Renee Bryant and Patrick Green. Is that correct? I see. Have you testified?
I can quickly just say, Patrick Green, Oregon. For the record, I'm Patrick Green with the Oregon AFL-CIO, and I won't go into. I think that what Bob Shiprack testified to is, as well as AOI, is important, especially just to remember that the current law currently assumes that a worker is a worker unless proved otherwise, and has a set criteria. There's nothing in the law, nothing in this bill that, or nothing in the current law that prevents people from working in their home, and so it's hard to see how that can't happen. You know, we do believe that there should be set standards. There should be clear standards. Everybody understands what an employer-employee relationship is, and that way everybody can follow the law. And there's no question that workers are protected under unemployment and workers' compensation. So with that, we oppose the bill in its current form. And I think that with that, unless there's any question, I can hand it off to the Employment Department.
Patrick, I guess I'd ask you to address some of the comments that the ladies made from Blatchley about you know, a large family with a lot of children, and I assume they're saying that it would be prohibitive cost wise to put in phone lines, or I'm not sure, but did you hear that testimony?
I did hear that testimony.
Can you just comment on it?
Well, part of it is that, I mean, and I don't know the specifics of this case, but I would say that it's, according to the law, it's not just the phone lines. There's six criteria, and they can meet four of them. So if they can't meet the phone lines, then what other criteria then can they meet? And I think Representative Kitts went over some of those. There is an opportunity for people to comply. They don't have to be perfect in order to do that.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Other questions? Representative Shoffman.
It's more a comment, and I'm going off testimony you heard today, so I don't know if the math is exact, but I heard both the folks that work for or with
LRI, say $1,100 to $1,200 a month. And now I heard it was estimated at $11 an hour. That's $1,200 a week. At $11 an hour at 40 hours is $440 a week. And according to Representative Kitt's math, now I'm using all these numbers, assuming that they're correct. That's $150 a week. I assume that, or was that a month you came at, $150 a month?
Yeah, it was $60 for a phone install, $60 for business card investment with a monthly phone rate of $32 and a $10 business.
Okay. Then, doing all that, putting that all together, it would seem that the good folks that assemble these things can't afford not to comply with the law and stay working out of their house. That they're even with the restrictions as the law exists today, they would still be making more money if they met the criteria in the laws as exist today, rather than driving all that time, wearing out the roads, polluting, being away from your family. And I can appreciate that. Up until I got this hired at this job, I'm an independent contractor. My wife is an independent contractor. We have to jump through all these hoops, and my little girl didn't go to a field trip until without a parent with her, and I was usually the one, until I got hired to this job. So I can appreciate where you're coming from there. But doing all that math, you put all that math together, and I don't think you folks can afford not to meet the criteria and stay working at home. It all adds up to me anyway.
Okay, let's go to the employment. Were there further questions for Patrick?
I'll wait.
All right.
Thank you.
Let's go to Renee Bryant.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Renee Bryant, Tax Manager for the Employment Department. In the interest of brevity, I won't read all of the prepared testimony. We've given that to the members of the committee. But I would just like to say and emphasize that we believe that House Bill 2649 will increase the number of persons who are not covered for unemployment insurance purposes. It will decrease the number of employer contributions to the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. And I'd like to emphasize that this particular statute was designed to focus on the characteristics of individuals who operate independently established businesses for the purposes of being defined as an independent contractor. That's the only part of the statute that this bill seeks to amend. The law was enacted to protect workers in a job relationship. That is where there's a relationship between an individual and a single employer, basically. When that single employer disappears, there's unemployment. And given that, and also the emphasis on the nature of entrepreneurial risk that goes along with an independently established business, those were some of the things that the subsection 8 of the statute focused on. It was designed to describe how business really operates, and our experience in the employment department has been that when you have a business, you satisfy these criteria. The purpose of unemployment insurance is to provide a broad base of economic stability for communities, families, and individuals during periods of economic stress. Accordingly, the underlying policies of the system provide for broad definitions of employment in order to ensure that maximum numbers are covered during those periods of time. When rural communities or other communities are under stress, it's the unemployment insurance that goes to employees or former employees that helps support those communities, helps individuals go to the grocery stores and the gas stations and so forth, so that there's not secondary unemployment that occurs as a result of the economic deprivation. Unemployment insurance has pumped more than $1.2 billion into the Oregon economy in the past couple of years. More coverage means a greater infusion of money into depressed areas during economic downturns. For the purposes of unemployment insurance, historic public policy has been to provide coverage for any person who relies on a single employment relationship. And there's really good language out of a particular court case that says the act was designed to cover persons who are peculiarly subjected to the hazard of unemployment because of the nature of their occupation. In other words, the program is designed to provide coverage for persons who face the risk of becoming unemployed based upon the nature of their relationship with the employer. House Bill 2649 will make individuals independent contractors even in situations where they don't operate an independent business and they are, in fact, reliant on a single employment relationship. This legislation defeats the purpose for which the statute was originally drafted. As Bob Shipwright testified, the Employment Advisory Council has voted to oppose this bill. That council is made up of 12 individuals equally representing labor, management, and the public. For the above-discussed reasons and our concern about the erosion of worker coverage in general, the Employment Department opposes this legislation. Nevertheless, if this committee believes that there are significant issues of public policy that have been raised that we need further discussion, we're more than happy to sit down with a work group. We'd be more than happy to sit down with the sponsors of this bill to talk about other ways to achieve an exclusion or exemption that wouldn't have quite these kinds of broad ramifications. We did invite Mr. Allen in the past during the last summer to sit down and do that, and he refused to do so. And I'll be happy to take questions. I would like to clarify just a couple of quick things, and I know that you are very pressed for time. Nothing in existing law prevents Mr. Allen from hiring people to work out of their homes, period. He can hire those people to work out of their homes, but if they do not meet the criteria of the statute, if they're not running businesses, they're employees, and he has to pay unemployment insurance taxes. And he's been doing that ever since we conducted our audit. There hasn't been a problem with that. Mr. Allen's choice to take his business somewhere else is not because he has employees. I mean, he can choose to bring them in and work. He can choose to pay them piece rate. He can choose to pay them by the hour. Those are business choices that he makes. It's not a requirement of the law, Employment Department law, that people cannot work in their homes. This law, 670-600, is not the same law that is used by Workers' Comp and Safe. So that even if this law were changed according to the amendments offered in this bill, Mr. Allen wouldn't be in a position of getting a better safe insurance necessarily. I don't know how this would affect the interpretation for Workers' Comp purposes. And I just want to make that clear to the committee.
Renee, my question is, suppose these employees say, you know, we've read the law, we understand that we're giving up our unemployment compensation, and we choose to make that choice, you know, we're going to take the risk. Why shouldn't the state give them that flexibility, and what would be the outcome if you did give them that flexibility?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I believe this is an issue that's been considered by policymakers many times in the past, and my understanding is that there is a basic understanding that in most situations, people seeking jobs don't have a lot of bargaining power, especially during periods where there are 800 people applying for a single job. It's the employer who gets to dictate the terms of the employment relationship. And in those situations, and in fact, I've seen it many, many times in the Employment Department over the last several years, people will sign anything. Yes, I'm an independent contractor. Yes, I will work for less than minimum wage. Yes, I'll take money under the table. They'll do what they have to do to get the employment. When that employment ends for whatever reason, they run to the Employment Department and say, he made me do this, but I really was an employee. Give me my benefits. So it's to avoid those kinds of situations.
Representative Gallegos and Rosenbaum. My question has to do with, really there's two issues. To me, there's two issues. One, the Employment Department has an issue with LRI, and the Employment Office has an issue with the individuals who claim that they are independent contractors. And I think the employment, what I'm hearing is that the Employment Office has determined that this is all one issue. I'd like to know about the individuals who have portrayed themselves as independent contractors. What were they not meeting in the criteria?
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, I don't have the audit here available with me. It was conducted prior to the time that I became tax manager, but I'll give you the information that I have available. Depending on each individual, it could have been any of the six criteria that they failed to meet. It could be because they didn't have a telephone line that was dedicated to a business purpose. It could be because they didn't take risk for defects in workmanship. It could have been because they didn't advertise. It could have been any number of those factors. The Employment Department, what we will do is go through and examine on a case-by-case basis the nature of the relationship between the employer and the worker and determine on a case-by-case basis whether or not there's an employment relationship or an independent contractor relationship. And I don't know if that answers your question. Is there more that you would like for me to try to explain?
Well, it would have been helpful to have the audit information here.
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, that information is generally confidential, and if you would like for us to share it with you privately, I believe that we have the authority to do that, but it wouldn't be the kind of information that we would normally like to make public without the employer's consent.
Follow-up? Were there any of the independent contractors who individually had met all the criteria, or did was it one ruling that everybody, based on who the LRI?
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, I believe that we concluded that all of the individuals were employees in this situation. There are numbers of cases that we investigate where, in fact, we find that some people are independent contractors and others are not, depending on...
But in this particular case, so...
To my knowledge, I would have to go back and double-check, but I believe that's correct.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Renee, I had a question about the language in the bill that says one of the two criteria that you would be required to meet under this bill is that you perform labor services at a dedicated location. Do you know what, I mean, I guess you can't tell us how that would play out in terms of rulemaking, but what does that language mean in terms of what a dedicated location sounds like? It could be my home, it could be any place where I just work routinely.
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I do have some concerns about this language for the same reasons you do. I don't know what dedicated means. I know what dedicated meant, I believe, for the purposes of LRI. But in this case, the bigger concern that I would have in terms of rulemaking would be because the legislature acted to take out the specific definers here to say what dedicated is, that then we wouldn't have the authority as an agency to go in and do rulemaking, which would clarify what that would be.
And a follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. What happens when a group of employees hasn't been covered under unemployment insurance and then a ruling that, like this one, comes down that they should have been and their status has to change? Are they eligible for unemployment for that whole period of time that they've been working when they should have been covered as employees?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, when the Employment Department goes out and performs an audit, depending on a number of different factors, we may go back 1 year, 3 years, sometimes 7 years, depending on, as I said, several factors, all of which don't come to mind. I apologize to the committee. When an individual files an unemployment insurance claim, they generally go back about five quarters to determine their qualification for benefits and their weekly benefit amount and so forth and so on. So if, for instance, we would audit an employer and go back 3 years and pick up back taxes is what we would be doing for this period of time, the individual would still have a claim based only on the last five quarters of employment prior to the separation.
Okay, I'm going to go to our last two people. Thank you so much. It's very helpful what you've prepared.
Thank you.
Your name. Kim Welsh, and we have one last person who signed up late, Narjis Shadza.
Chair Close and committee members, I'm Jim Welsh, Oregon State Grange, and we put together this piece of legislation directly from the resolution from the Oregon State Grange, and we also have asked legislative counsel as of a week or so ago with the help of Representative Brown to draw up some more amendments that would really carve out an exemption or exclusion for this classification of independent contractors. Now, we understand that may be possible. We appreciate all the comments today from everyone, and we have identified those concerns, and we would like to work with those people in a work group and take on their concerns and see if we can't still come up with something that will certainly help this group of independent contractors in Blatchley. I think one of the within that set of criteria, subs A through F in Oregon statute under 670-600, and I understand that after, of course, and I knew this before, but talking or listening to the unemployment department, that 657, we may have to take on that chapter also, but we can work with them and take on their concerns also and come back to you, Chair, with an amendment, hopefully, that will certainly help the independent contractors. I appreciate all the work in 1987, and We have to understand, though, with the advent of high tech today and what is occurring at the home, I think there are millions possibly out there that do not comply even with national statute. We need to move into the 21st century in this issue. Yes, there needs to be protection for certain employee and employer relationships. There's no doubt. And due to economy of scale, there and coming from an employer situation, I understand we couldn't have made lumber and had them do it at home. They had to be under a roof. But how many large facilities are available, and how many other contractors or employers are available in a small rural community 35 miles from or 40 miles from a larger community, an urban area, where you see a lot more industrially zoned land and more industry housed under one location? You don't see it. You won't see it in Blatchley, Oregon, and I can guarantee you land use rules in Oregon wouldn't allow it. We have a commitment from Dallas and David Allen to this community and to Oregon in trying to keep as many jobs here statewide, and I think that's very important. I think we owe it to them. It is this body's responsibility to take this issue on and see if we can't carve out exemption that addresses all the other concerns also, because I still think we can. I think we can do that, and I will be dedicated to helping in every way possible, because I think we can address everything that you heard today. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jim. I appreciate you being willing to work with all the parties, and we have the list of the pros and cons that we could pick the work group from, so with Representative Brown's approval, we will do that.
Chair Close, we do have some other important information here that Representative Brown said, and we have the appeals, and if we're allowed to, we can share that with the committee, and all this information then needs to be given back to Representative Brown's office. But there is more information here, statement of the case, a letter from the Blatchley School District, and I think some other statements from the Employment Department. So there is more information if the committee members would like that.
Thank you. We will intend to schedule you again in 2 weeks, if that would be enough time to come up with amendments and meet and continue on this issue. Thank you.
Okay. And last we have Narges. Is it Narges?
It's Narges Shadbe.
Narges.
N-A-R-G-S-S-S-H-A-B-B-E-H. Good morning, and thanks for the opportunity to testify. I work at the Oregon Law Center. I'm a lawyer, represent farm workers. And I'm not familiar with the case that has brought attention to this issue this morning, but it sounds like it's folks who want to be classified as or want to be independent contractors because they think that it works out better for them economically. And I'm worried about folks who don't want to have no intention of wanting to hold out to the world as independent contractors, and by deterioration of these standards fall into that category. One example that worries me, at least in the farm worker or agricultural sector, is there's a provision in subsection 8 here that basically if you meet two of the standards, you could meet the test under subsection 8. And one is if you have a written agreement, and then if you assume financial responsibility. And at least in the agricultural world, the workers are supposed to be given a written agreement ahead of time. I mean, we advocate for that. The law provides for that. So that's a good thing. But a worker who gets a written agreement, arguably that could be a contract, and then assumes financial responsibility, say, for bruising cucumbers or crushing strawberries, does that person then fall into the category of meeting the independently established independent contractor. I mean, I don't think that's the intention of anybody, but as it's written, those folks would be in that category and then would have to argue their way out of it. And I just would like to urge the committee to balance the threat of potential job loss in Oregon with the lowering the standard of protection for wage earners, not just farm workers, across the state, and to prevent wage earners in the state from turning out fending for themselves in the most vulnerable situations. Thanks.
Schaffer.
Actually, it's not a question for you. It was from a previous testifier. I'm sorry.
Jim,
excuse me. The information that Representative Brown has, you're going to provide us with copies of that, or we have to go around and read it and then give it back to him. Did I understand you correctly?
We can allow the committee administrator to make copies for you, I'm sure.
Okay.
That'd work out very well. I think it's very important to see within the appeals here that what the independent contractors ask for, and to be able to comply with some of the criteria, that the employment department did not allow that. And so they were basically addressed as a group. So individually, if some of them could have met those criteria, they weren't allowed to. I think you'll read that. I think it's very important to take a look at this case, because I think we have some discrimination issues here, just because of the situation in that area. And I think we have an overstepping, possibly, that shouldn't occur. And I think we need to address that. I know this body can, and we need to take a look at that very closely.
And if you have summaries of those documents, we would welcome. I don't know how many pages they are. But
Chair Close, committee, great nighttime meeting. There's quite a few pages.
Okay. And if you have any kind of summary, that would be helpful.
Oh.
And Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Jim. I can see if I was in this employer or this company, there are several reasons I'd prefer to have a contract relationship. One is unemployment insurance. When it was mentioned how an order comes in, a lot of work needs to be done, and the order is not there, and then do people file for unemployment insurance and therefore drive up rates? And quite frankly, I've had that experience with translators who worked for us and then filed for unemployment insurance, and it was definitely intermittent work. So that is kind of a challenge within the employment relationship. But in terms of, since the company has now found a way to keep a number of people employed at a site, what is the real obstacle here to them also employing those people but letting them work in their home? What prevents them from working in their home?
Chair Close, Representative Merkley, I'm not sure all the details that and I wrote down your question previously, and I understand what you're trying to get at here. I think it has everything to do with the economy of the situation between the relationship of the employer and employee. And I think it has everything also to do with an agreement between them that this will work. And that has to be something that both sides understand, and certainly the contractor, the independent contractor, has to understand too, that they will not receive unemployment benefits if they maintain the status as an independent contractor. They can't go back after working a period of time as an independent contractor and ask for unemployment. And they agree on that. And believe me, this issue in Blatchy, all those who participate as independent contractors understand. They lived with that. They had their own, they bought their own insurance, and they realized that if LRA ever left the community, they'd be out of a job and they could not gain unemployment benefits of any kind. So that is an agreement, again, between an employer and an employee that has to be honored. And both sides need to understand. I think that your question, we need to get a full answer, because, and I'll go out and seek that and work with the employment department on gaining a good answer to that and what a company would have to do. But it would be extra cost for them, and they wouldn't get the kind of production they wanted either. So there's all sorts of different things that go into this, as I'm sure you probably understand.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much. We've lost our committee, but thank you all for coming, and we appreciate the little lights. Very interesting, and we will continue working on this issue. And I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2649, and we are adjourned.